It's Wednesday, December 12, 2007, and you're listening to episode 82 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 5 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is John.
My name is Luke.
My name is Adam.
And I'm Keith.
And Keith, some of you will recognize as Keith Curtis from the forums, and even those of you that don't use the forums, if you grab some RPG books around your house and start checking the credits, you might find Mr. Curtis's name in there. And Keith, I was wondering if, before we got into the episode, if you could give us something of a resume of yours back in the role-playing industry.
Well, let's see. I started about 6 or 7 years ago doing actual stuff for the role-playing industry as opposed to just being a gamer doing stuff for myself. Started out with Hero Games, submitted some samples to the company that had just been bought and they were looking to start up again. And I thought, you know, I'd give this a shot. And they liked my stuff and I did many, 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 many books for Hero. Since then, I've done work for Pinnacle and Mongoose. Basically, a lot of the middle tier role-playing games, role-playing game companies. I haven't done anything for, like, say, White Wolf, Wizards of the Coast. And then I've also done a lot of stuff for the lower tier or for like PDF-only type productions. But I've probably got about 50 publishing credits by now. And I'd say that about 80 to 90% of those are all cartography credits. I've done a lot of illustration, but cartography is really my bread and butter in the industry. It's my niche.
Now, in addition to doing stuff for role-playing game companies, you also do some commission art on the side. In fact, I just hired you to do a drawing. I'm about to hire you to do a second.
Hooray!
Yeah, obviously showing I was pleased with the first.
I need a Labian with Choctaw hair. So,
it's
that.
Beware the Labian's natural predator, the clitorati.
If you are interested in hiring Keith here to do something on a commission basis or for a role-playing project or whatever, be sure to check out his website at kacurtis, that's kacurtis.com, which we will also link in the show notes. So check that out. And before we get into this, I want to explain why we're doing this as a guest host rather than an interview.
What do you mean? Because none of us are professional cartographers?
Well, that's part of it. We wanted to talk about maps within role-playing games because maps are such a critical part of the game. And while we could certainly sit here and bitch and bicker for a while,
which we will probably do anyway.
We would call that an episode of Fear the Boot.
Welcome to Fear the Boot. Yeah. This is your first
check
episode.
Out 80 episodes.
This is a bonus episode. Don't listen to it.
But effort.
We fear we go and bring in somebody who actually knows something about the subject. So in this particular show, we are picking Keith's brain for his professional know-how and experience rather than his resume itself, which is why we're doing this as a guest host rather than an interview. Now, before we started the show up, though, I found out two interesting things that as banter topics we just have to pursue. One is, Keith, you sing Barbershop.
Yes, I do. Yes,
do you
I
have do. The striped shirt and the hat?
No, actually, our dress uniform is a white tux jacket.
Oh, that's even cooler.
Pants, a blue sequined cummerbund. And I'll see if I
and
can.
Actually, you know what? I can even give you some more dirt. Today, Keith Curtis sent me a submission that he made to some... What was the site?
Oh, Singshot. I got that from Jim in Buffalo. Hi, Jim in Buffalo. This is an online karaoke.
Oh,
what?
Lord. It's
what?
Not karaoke.
Tell
that
me more right now.
Karaoke. Anyway, it's an online sing-it-yourself website. And basically, they just have, you know, a huge catalog of songs all set up for that style of singing. You choose one, and you basically sing into your microphone at home. The little words come up, and afterwards, you listen to it. If you like it, you can save it. And if you really like it, and you're a brave soul, you can publish it.
That's awesome.
I am in.
What's the web address on this? I'll put this as
Singshot.com?
Singshot. Just like Slingshot, but without an L.
This appeals to me at some base primal level that I've never felt before.
I can make so many more YTMNDs now.
Before we recorded, I was trying to get Keith to sing Sweet Adelaide to me, but he wouldn't do it because he said he was lacking his other parts.
That's because it's kind of creepy. He just told you that part about the other parts because he wanted
you can't
to save
force
your
art from a true artist, Dan. You have to respect Keith.
So I know. Now we're going to have a bonus episode where he comes back on with his entire quartet.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
I'll
have to tell you this. On the forums, I'm like the old guy. I'm like 44 years old. So I'm like in the top, like, you know, 2% of the age group there. I am the kid at the meetings of SPEBSQA, which is the Society for the Preservation and blah, 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 barbershop quartet thing in America. nobody remembers what it means. But no,
at that age.
There I'm the kid. We had one 20-year-old guy sign up. And, like, I was thinking, this is great. This is great because I can hang with him and we're going to be the young guys and be all the old guys over there. And then two more guys in their 20s signed up.
Uh-oh. And
they started to hang together. And, like, overnight, I became one of the old guys.
Did the old guys accept you as one of them after that with the contrast of the 20-year-olds?
Somewhat. I was mentioning the other day some date came up, and the guy said, oh, yeah, I remember that. That was the date he signed me up for the Navy, and he said the year, and that was the year I was born. So,
I was actually about to ask if you could tell us any great stories about the European theater or the Battle of the Bulge. Or...
No, I did. I did once have a guy, a kid in a movie theater, ask me if I had fought in Vietnam, and I told them they didn't. They didn't take 6-year olds. So,
well, no, our side didn't anyway.
Yeah. Wow.
I lied about my age.
The other thing that I wanted to bring up that you mentioned before the show, and actually you've mentioned this on the forums as well.
Bet you regret talking to us now, don't you?
Is that you were an extra on Army of Darkness.
Yes, I was.
What did you do?
First of all, how I got involved there, I have to give full props and credits here. My wife was working as an armorer on Army of Darkness. Now, armory on the movie set refers to like vacuform plastic armor. It's not real armor. So it's like the armor that all the extras wear. Bruce Campbell wore real armor. His armor is made of metal, but that's handled by costuming.
Just like his balls.
He's not as tall as you would think he is.
Is his chin as big as we think?
Twice as big. Twice as big. I've got some Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, if chins could kill.
So we went down there to visit. I had some other friends who were working on there too, which is how Susan got her job there. And I went down there to visit, and they said, hey, Keith, do you want to be an extra? And I'm thinking, yeah. So they get me all outfitted up, and I'm one of the soldiers, and they wanted me to be able to be seen on screen. So all of the armor had these knee pieces. What are they, pauldrons? Whatever the knee piece is.
No, those are the greaves.
Big metal knee pads made of plastic.
Yes, pauldrons are shoulders.
Somebody pull up Morrowind real quick.
There was a scene where somebody's supposed to come in and kneel and deliver a message from the front or whatever, and every time the guy came in, he would kneel on that plastic knee pad and crack it right in half. And so they'd say, okay, just kneel, but don't put any weight on it. And he'd come in, message from the front, crack. So they had one set of these left. They said, Keith, we're going to give these to you. You will be the only person in the entire movie who has knee armor. If you are visible in any scene, we will be able to pick you out, no matter the distance, by the fact that you're the only person that has knee armor.
Oh, now I got to go watch this movie again. Thanks, Keith.
Don't bother. Don't look. Because the only scene in which I'm visible, if you watch it on video, I'm like 4 scanning lines high. But the third scanning line from the top, that's slightly lighter than the other ones around it. So.
Yes.
I came to find out I was only several thousand miles away from being an elf in Lord of the Rings, because apparently if
several thousand miles.
They were looking for long-haired, beautiful men.
Well, I mean, for all jokes aside, yeah, that when they were doing like some of the battle scenes, they did not have sufficient tall, skinny, fine-featured people. And so they were literally just like driving around to the restaurants and taverns and such, just trying to find people that fit the physique of an elf.
And you just didn't happen to be in New Zealand.
And I just didn't happen to be in New Zealand at the time, despite my many stopovers there.
I am in the Styx REO Speedwagon concert video for Arch Allies.
Really?
As they scan across the crowd, they slow down just enough, and there's a big space in front of my friends and I in the lawn.
You showing your boobs?
Well, my boobs first. And then you can tell I'm in a big Hawaiian shirt, because I was in my fat guy Hawaiian shirt face. And then I was, I'm there drinking, and you just see me going, woo! As it pans by, and I'm very visible.
Wow. You're an REO Speedwagon concert.
I went to several REO Speedwagon concerts.
I would go to
thank
one.
You. And Styx and Robert Palmer.
Trivia question. What does REO stand for?
I used to know this. They played on my street corner in Hillsborough, Illinois, back before they were famous.
And what is it?
I don't remember.
REO Ransom E. Olds Speedwagon is a fire engine.
Oh.
It's my one bit of musical trivia, and I was going to save it for your next trivia show, but no. I use it now.
You can still ask.
Well, you know, our trivia shows are unbalanced. They're too broad, so they favor me.
Just cut that out and paste it into another episode.
All righty, one announcement before we dig down into what we're going to talk about this show, since we haven't been talking up to this point. That's actually a really stupid statement, but we'll go ahead and leave that in there just for comedic value.
I'll leave it in there so you look foolish.
Okay.
It knocks you down a notch.
Thank you.
He needs a few notches taken off.
Fear the Con is still coming up on March 8th. We now have a temporary site on Warhorn where...
Not really temporary. It's the site.
Okay, well, it's the site. We have the Fear the Con domain name reserved. We're not doing anything with it right now, so don't go to that. We will put up in the show notes a link to our site on Warhorn, where you can go, you can pre-register, purchase tickets. I believe, is there event sign-up on there?
Right now, we need to get the GM signed up. Obviously, we will be very shortly. The celebrity games, I guess. The
host games. You're so full of yourself.
Yeah, right.
Dude, we're so B-list. Oh, maybe B-minus at the lowest.
I'd call a C or D.
Man, I got people beating down my door for shampoo commercials.
Double D. I'm on the double D list. Warhorn's going to be our official site. We're going to have at least the host games up. I'm going to contact everybody who's talking about GMing and see if I can get their blurbs yet. So hope as time goes on, more and more will become available.
But there will also be some general information like the exact location of the con, the hotel where we've got the group rate discount, whatever information we can get up there, we will get up
pricing, there. Pricing, pre-reg.
Yeah, pricing, all that kind of stuff, what you can expect, what's going to be going on.
Pre-regging gets you, besides a little discount, it also guarantees you get into the games you want as long as you register soon enough because you reserve spots in games.
Because, for example, some of the games, there may be only like one or two shots running with like six players, so be sure to check that out. And also, we are still going to do a bonus episode with some more details as the time draws nearer. But in the meantime, check the show notes for a link to that Warhorn thing. Get pre-registered. Check out what we got going on. And we're really hoping that we can make this convention a real gangbusters thing. So hope to see you guys there. Gaming in a distracting environment.
Podcasting in a distracting environment.
What is that noise right now?
Carl's watching
TV. Distraction.
Actually, yeah, this is...
Actually, I wasn't even making a comment about that. I was just making a comment about how we can never stay on topic or... Luke always hits the table because he's a jerk face.
That's what I do, Ben. I make you work harder.
Yeah, I know. Thank you.
Between the Care Bears and the TV beer upstairs. And on top of that, we have Keith on Skype, obviously. And Keith is videoed on Skype. So it's like he's at the table. We have this gigantic full screen image of Keith Curtis. His head is actually bigger than it may really be. And
no, not right now, according to my wife. No.
Oh.
You're going to be on Fear the Boot. You're going to be impossible to live with. You know that?
You know the Great Gatsby where the sign is always watching them? It's like that with Keith right now.
That was a very cultured reference, Adam.
In fact, it might be the
most one that has ever dropped on Fear the Boot.
I hate that book.
I never read it.
I can be totally with you on that. I did not enjoy that book.
I read it. I don't remember a thing about it, so I must not have enjoyed it.
Gaming in a distracting environment, my insight here, I'm going to have to collect because my initial response is, I can't do it.
That, my initial response is, get out of the environment.
Well,
my initial response is, be louder than everybody else and be excited and bring make people wonder why you're being so loud.
See, some of this is just because of the way that I game. When I sit down to a game, I really like to get into it. I like the deep characters. I like the deep RP. Which I realized I'm kind of somewhat at friction with the games I'm running right now because certain two people, well, Adam in particular, doesn't like doing that. But
I'm not stopping you.
I really kind of need that zone. And once the momentum starts, once people are in that zone, they're in their characters, the plot's picking up, they're starting to realize all the things that are going on. There's this enormous amount of momentum that carries itself until a phone rings or a girlfriend walks in or in the days of yore, mom and dad scream from the top of the stairs, hold it down, and all of a sudden, that whole thing is broken. It's like somebody's screaming or tittering or their cell phone ringing in the middle of a movie. It just completely breaks your suspension of disbelief.
Oh, I hate the titters. Week.
I kicked over a beer bottle at the end of Spider-Man 3 and ruined it.
No,
you probably made it better.
It did make it better. The whole theater cracked up.
Did you see Sean? You probably heard Venom more than he did.
Well, if the distraction is big enough, if it's like a phone call, you've got to be prepared to just stop and just say, okay, you know, everybody take five. It's a bathroom break. Go get snacks. Go get drinks, whatever. Because if you try and keep going during that, it's going to be painful. You, it's better to just stop, and then get the momentum back than try and keep it limping along through somebody, you know, talking to the girlfriend. Yeah, I'm going to be home in an hour. I'm going to be home in an hour. It's okay. We're almost done.
That's why I have a, phone off policy.
Okay.
I actually looked into a cell phone jammer. They're really not. I'm dead serious. Back with gaming with Tim in particular, I mean, we could not go 3 minutes without his wife calling. And so
she wanted to know how the game was going.
Yeah, I wish that was what it was about. So I seriously started looking into a cell phone jammer that I was just going to attach to the underside of the table and came to find out they're really not all that expensive. So for
not expensive for regular people and not expensive for the Dan Gold Card budget?
They've come down
that
in price.
Second one.
I believe they're now within the price range of what any average Joe, if you really want one, could afford. It's been a little while since I've price checked them, but I've been told, last time I checked when they were about 200, I've been told they're now down to about like 30 to 50. So there is.
I never plan on buying this.
There is some pseudo legality to it. But if you are one of those people where you've got that friend who just cannot put his damn cell phone down, he'll never be the wiser if there's a jammer under the table. Just, hey.
Are you trying to tell me to buy one of these things?
You can take a shotgun to his phone.
I was going to suggest that, Adam.
The network just doesn't get good reception out at his place.
I have a phone off policy. And my gaming table, phones are off or silenced until when we take a break. You're welcome to check your messages, but while we're there, no huge distractions.
I don't enforce a policy on my players, but I myself never answer a phone when I'm playing, and obviously never ever when I'm running.
What do you do about distracting individuals? Especially, well, let's say two types of distracting individuals. Let's start with those that are not in the game.
Look, there are two things. I think there are two categories of people who get distracted during the game. People start acting up or being loud or talking amongst themselves when either they are completely disinterested in the game, they are completely bored and have no interest, or they may be interested, but the spotlight's been on somebody else for too long.
Well, let me throw in another one there. They're general ADD. I've had other people where game's interesting, they're into the game, the spotlight may even be on them right this moment.
I don't think that's... I
have seen this.
Whoa.
I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure.
I have not gamed with the same people.
Yeah.
Obviously not.
I have seen it many times.
Actually, you and I have.
Of course, it would be erroneous to attribute every single incident of that to this third cause.
Yeah, I would think that'd be more rare than anything else. I mean, when if that's coming up a lot, you need to look in the mirror a bit, make sure you're spreading the love around enough.
Well, I look around the table, and when it's just one person, you know, then it's kind of, you start to, okay, maybe this is the issue. If everyone...
True. Yeah.
You've also got the problem when it's two people who are not in the spotlight at the moment, and they might think they're not being distracting, but they're sitting over there saying, yeah, did you see what Wolverine did in the last issue? Yeah, I can't believe
it. Oh, it's the Legion.
I cut down half. Yeah. And they might think they're not being distracting, but you got to find some way of saying, excuse me, you guys are sitting at opposite ends of the table, and you think you're whispering.
You got to watch that because
you
got to
give them minus DKP.
It does. Well, you know what? When that happens, when something like that comes up and everybody gets infected, my theory, run with it. Run with it for a minute or two. Let everybody get out of their system and then deep breath back into the game. That has worked really, really well for me.
I do the school marm thing. I just stop talking. I just sit there, fold my arms, sit in the chair and glower.
And shame them.
Yeah, and see, it works.
As somebody who feels no shame, that would have no effect on me.
Oh, it works.
I would continue talking about whatever topic I was talking about.
I have never had it fail me yet.
What you got to watch out for, too, is occasionally two people, if they're, the spotlight's not on them, they will roleplay in character about just something between themselves. That doesn't happen often. It's great when it does.
Yeah. Oh, I'd bring the hammer down on that. You can't have that.
Well, you, of course.
I do it in your game from time to time, Adam.
Well, I'm not paying attention.
Well, that's true. That's easier because if they're actually on topic, just distracting, they just say, hey, why don't you guys go sit in the next room over, as opposed to if they're distracting and off topic, where if you put them in a room by themselves, then it's going to be YouTube or a video game by the time you go back to get them.
Well, if you're in character role-playing against each other, you can you can become part of the ambiance of the scene. Like, we're always in the back of that truck in Adam's game, and the... three characters that aren't being spoken to at the moment will often talk to one another, and it's cool. It's roleplay. That's why we're here.
Yeah, it's one of those neat things when you're a GM and you notice that going on. Those two people are whispering over there. Wait a minute. They're whispering in character.
Yes.
And then
you don't know something.
I'm GM. I have to know what's going on.
I've occasionally missed stuff, and I'm like, what? What was that? That sounded awesome. They're like, oh, it was, but we can't talk about it right now. I'm like, oh, tell me about it after the game.
Turnabout, man, is the worst.
So, Keith, does your wife roleplay?
Yes, she does, as a matter of fact. As a matter of fact, she has threatened physical violence upon me for not GMing often enough.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's, a good woman. That's one of those good problems to have, if you give me.
It's like having a wife that's too hot.
But she does have some quirks. Like, we'll be, you know, it's after the game is over, you know, we, you know, getting ready for bed, and she'll say, "So, tell me a secret."
Oh, the wife card.
What's going on? I can't tell you. That is cheating. No, that's not even important. I just want to know something they don't.
We call that economics.
We call that women. Yeah, women in general.
I'm with Adam. We call that economics because then it's like, well, what would you give me for a secret?
See, I was at a Hackmaster game for 3 years where the GM's wife was totally our spy. She would go in there, seduce the GM, get the secrets from what we know, and pass along to the players so we knew, and he never knew the difference.
Oh,
we're not
going to
walk through that door. We heard things about the red door. We'll go through the other one.
You know, actually, I had that broken down into two topics, distracting players outside of the game, distracting players inside of the game, and I think we discovered both.
Yeah, we did.
So, let's get on the maps.
Let's talk about the Kessel Run again.
Since that debate's exploded.
Yeah, 5 pages.
Like I said, that's probably what Tony Mass has to deal with every time he posts a Fanboy
Sci-Fi
Smackdown.
Hey. Man, I'm turning to look at the screen when I talk to you.
This is perfect. Why don't we have text on this? That makes it so much better.
Text doesn't have a Mac. See, this is every single Mac on Earth now.
Apple sanctimoniousness.
No. Let's say I'm fully aware of my limitations as well.
Both of my laptops have webcams. It's just the desktop we record on, which has the high power sound card, doesn't. Like I said, I think I need to get one because this is now the second time we've had somebody on Skype and they are doing a video and we're not. And I just feel so guilty. It's like you show me yours and I'll show you mine, and then I back out.
This is one of those issue things.
Get that gold card going. I mean, you've got everything else over there. You need video.
Well, the webcam's cheap. I mean, heck, I could probably just put that in a Christmas list.
$25.
Yeah, it's like $25 or something.
You should get 4 webcams so we can have like that Nod Intercouncil video relay thing going on. That'd be amazing.
Let's get down to Keith's real speciality here, which hopefully is not distracting games. But is
making
the maps, because Keith, you've said that while you certainly do illustration, that the thing you are tapped for most often is mapping. And
that is...
Luke is giggling like a schoolgirl. Did I?
You said taps.
You said titters.
And obviously something you've got to do when you're developing a source book or a module. But every GM that wants to create his own setting or wants to create his own adventure, which is the vast majority of GMs out there, has to sit down at some point and draw the maps. And when we were talking about this before the show, you were able to give us 3 basic categories of maps that you think each have their own distinct properties and approaches. So, trusting you as the expert, we will follow your outline. So let's start with the first one.
This is how we dodge having to come up with an outline.
Well, actually, I started an outline. This is how I'm dodging responsibility if it doesn't pan out.
1A.
So the first one is the overland, the world map, the galaxy map, the most macro map that you have. So, Keith, how do you get started drawing one of those?
Well, it depends on if I'm doing it for myself or if I'm doing it for a client. If I'm doing it for a client, then they've probably already done all the background work and decided, you know, what things are going to go with. Sometimes they haven't. Sometimes they say, I just want that, and can you fill in the names?
For quacky dice.
Yeah, exactly. These are the tall mountains. They're next to the really big sea and the cold place up north.
The inn, color animal. All right, well, let's go with the ones you're doing for yourself, because that's probably more relevant to the average GM sitting at home.
Masturba mapping.
Well, the...
I don't know what you just said, but it was wrong.
The broad overland map, or the world map, is generally the map that is the visual depiction of your campaign. You can have page after page of description of kingdoms or planets or, you know, depending on your genre, what that is. The broad overland map shows the players this is the entirety of the area in which you can expect to be able to do things or expect your characters to have heard of these things. It gives a shape to the campaign, and I think it should, personally, I think it should be your prettiest map, or your map that has the most finished look to it, or the most evocative style to it, because it's going to be the map that gives your players ideas. It's going to be the map that's, you know, where somebody says, wow, look, that forest is right next to that volcano. I want to be a barbarian from that area. We'll be, you know, the forest volcano people.
Progressive rock band, the forest volcano people.
Exactly.
Featuring Krusk.
It's a reference document so that as people are looking through your area, they have a very good idea of how things fit together. You know, if you have a notice there and say the write-up of Kingdom X that they trade, fluvians with Kingdom Y, they can say, okay, well, Kingdom Y is on the other side of these mountains. Obviously, you know, that's not an easy journey to make. So, you know, we probably don't know the people from Kingdom Y that very well. The world map is the one that gives shape and character to your campaign.
Okay. If you live in St. Louis, you don't have to worry about knowing how to draw mountains, though. We found that out real quick.
You wouldn't believe the number of movies. I've been watching a lot of HBO lately in lieu of History Channel, and you would not believe the number of movies I've seen set in either Illinois or Missouri that have
the Rocky Mountains. That have the Rocky Mountains. Yeah.
In fact, Adam, you're watching Norman right now. A lot of that takes place in and around St. Louis, according to the plot. You would not believe the number of mountains in the background. But it strikes me there are three things there that you brought out that I want to kind of enumerate and reiterate, which is one, to use a good Fear the Boot term, that overland map is going to convey a lot about the feel. The names that you put on there, the kinds of things that are on the map, this is going to say a lot just about the emotional feel of the setting.
Like the map in Chainmail Bikini.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you go look, the dangerous looking map I have ever seen. It is. Places on that.
I've never seen a dangerous fjord, but I don't want to go there. I'll tell you that right now.
The swamp of death is right next to the mountains of terror, next to the plains of ickiness. There's no Tweedledumville or something.
People in fantasy worlds live the most miserable lives. The second thing, and this is kind of, well, second and third together, is that this number one shows opportunity to the players, whether it's opportunity for character backgrounds or opportunities for, hey, we should go there next. But it also gives plot opportunities. I go through this all the time running my own sci-fi game, my own homebrew sci-fi game, that I have to be real careful about where I put the party, because if I want to involve a particular faction or a particular alien race, I've got to make sure that I have them on the border of those two empires or within the operating reach of those two empires. Even going outside of my games, running Forgotten Realms, there have been times where I've said, wow, I'm running this great big campaign, but here's this one city or this one area that they're kind of by that I could tie into the plot. Molemaster, Luke's favorite destination.
Molemaster is the best place in the Forgotten Realms. Was like that. So many memories.
The names are now all evading me.
Keith, would you ever name a town Molemaster? I mean, come on.
Hey. I didn't name it.
Now, it's not Mole Master, it's Mole.
It's M-U-L. Mole.
Oh, 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 I thought M-O-L-E. No, I had a picture of
the
this
mole people.
Super Mario World Monty Mole running around back and forth, and I was like, this
no,
is dumb.
Mole Master.
Mole Master and Hillsfar and Zentel Keep all fighting each other and having a great time.
That's exciting.
Great time fighting each other.
Arakoka.
So, Keith, Zombie. What recommendations do you have for filling in an overland map? Because the two biggest problems that I found, I'm sitting down with a blank sheet of paper or empty PowerPoint session or whatever.
Or my whiteboard.
Ready to create an overland map. The two things I hit up against is, one, adding enough variety and realism to the map on the one hand, and then conversely to that, not getting so bogged down in details that the world map takes me weeks and weeks and weeks to complete. Because, like, if you look at a world map of Earth and start filling in all the noteworthy locations, you'll quickly understand exactly what the problem is.
Exactly so. And my advice on that would be to figure out where is the focus of the campaign. Where are your people most likely to be adventuring? And that's the place where you apply the most amount of detail. So you get the biggest bang for your buck. For instance, on the real world, if you're going to, say, run like a Marvel superheroes game, you're going to put a ton of information about New York City. You're going to have, you know, detailed maps of New York City, and then you can work your way out to that. And you might include, like, world capitals, like, you know, you might include a couple of, you know, notes about Paris or whatever like this. But you're not going to have a detailed map of Zimbabwe. It's not going to come up in your campaign hardly ever. You know, it's not likely to come up at all. So, yeah, you'd want to figure out, okay, where's the main thrust of the campaign going to be? Let's go with a fantasy world. I'm going to have a town where you're likely to have elves, dwarves, hobbits, you know, Arakocra, whatever your races are. And then you want to make sure you want to make sure you have sources for those people, or origins for those people to come from that is reasonably associated with that place.
In a WoW, we just spring from the earth. Is that not going to work here?
In WoW, regions just stop. Temperature changes. The altitude level is radically altered despite the fact that you didn't go up or down.
This little loading bar pops up like, oh, I'm waiting for this.
No, that's EQ.
I'm sorry.
That's EQ
gone.
In the same plane.
Yeah, I would suggest that you figure out where is going to be the center of your campaign. Where is the conflict going to occur? And you might want to leave yourself, some wiggle room later on. So, we're going to be traveling. It's going to be a tour of the realms type campaign. So eventually I'm going to want to detail those things. But for right now, I can just make do with, a name. I don't have to place any cities yet until, people start getting closer to that or start putting their attention there. You want to make sure that the area that you have decided to place the focus of the campaign has as its resources all the things you're going to need for that campaign. And then you're going to want to design your map around that. So if you're going to want to have, say, the area where all the different fantasy tropes occur, you're going to want to have an elven forest, within a day or a week or a month or whatever your time scale is for travel.
Lost Torian.
Keith, what do you use as your inspiration? Let's say you're getting ready to run a campaign. I hand you a blank sheet of paper. You're getting ready to start drawing your world map. What do you use as your inspiration to even get started? I mean, even just draw the first coastlines of the continents and things like that. Is there anything you can recommend for inspiration?
All right, so you're talking about like a planetary type map.
Yeah, planetary type.
Regardless of the genre, we're talking about a planetary.
Doing a little research, I found galactic maps are even more brutal because the habitable zone of any galaxy is so ridiculously limited that you just kind of have to accept the whole thing's BS anyway.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. You just make it up. It's like faster than light travel. If you're going to accept that, you can accept almost anything.
Well, the truth is if you faster than light travel really in much of any direction, you hit something that's uninhabitable for some reason. So let's just go ahead with the world map.
Okay.
Where would you get started? What do you draw on for inspiration? How do you make it look realistic and not just cheesy with, big block continents that have no real interaction and lack diversity of biosphere or diversity of landscape?
Well, one of the things I would suggest not doing is using one of those fractal generators.
Oh, we need to talk about that later.
They look pretty. They give pretty coastlines, but the continents they just lack any kind of realistic feel. They just look like spider webby things that reach all over the planet, which I guess is cool if you want to do a spider webby continent kind of campaign. But personally, I will start with the idea of what I said before, of figuring out the area. Like, say, I know that this area is going to be a crossroads for, many, many civilizations. It's going to be a trade route. Okay, so I'll want to engineer my geography to support that. It's got to be the only easy way to get from point A to point B, or the easiest way, or, along a waterway that feeds the rest of the continent, something that makes it important. But beyond that, I'll just doodle out a couple of main shapes. Okay, I want kind of a Mediterranean feel. So I'll need a narrowish sea surrounded by two main, two large land masses. So going with that idea, I'll sketch out roughly where I want them to be. And then, honestly, I just sit there and I fiddle in the coastline. Nowadays, I use a pad, a digital pad, and I'll just sit there and I'll just work that little line until I get something that I think has a realistic feel to it. I don't know if it's really any more complicated than that. I mean, you can look up things like, okay, what do real fjords look like? And what does a real fjord coastline look like? And how do the mountains interact with that?
I don't do research for my games.
I don't even know what a real fjord is.
I've actually bought a few PDFs on mapping about this because I'm a bit of a extremely amateur map maker. I love cartography, but I have no artistic ability.
Actually, did Savage Worlds tell you to do it, Luke?
Yeah, I went to the Clown College in Savage Worlds. They said, just doodle it with lipstick.
Along those lines, Keith, do you have, books on, like, atlases and things like that? Do you draw from the real world to inspire the settings you create?
Sometimes I do. Nowadays, mostly, I develop and make pretty other people's ideas. But back when I would start from scratch, developing my own worlds. One of the most valuable courses I ever took in college, and this actually was in junior college, I think, was physical geography course. And physical geography is not just geology and mountain formation and things like that. It also includes things like weather patterns and climate, just everything, soil types, everything that goes into making up a planet. And if you really want that verisimilitude, you can just, you know, get any kind of college level textbook on that stuff. And the new ones nowadays also come with little CDs in the back that have animations and all kinds of things. And they'll tell you things like, if you have mountains in a temperate zone in the northern hemisphere, on the east of them, you're going to have a rain shadow. You're going to, you know, because of the prevailing winds, you know, carrying moisture, they get stopped by the mountains. In the area where I live right now, I live on the Olympic Peninsula, we get about two-thirds, maybe a little bit less of the rain of Seattle because we are on the slope of a mountain. We're on the northern slope of a mountain. All the coastal rain that comes in gets stopped before it gets to us. And so we get comparatively very little rain, while the other side of the mountain is an honest-to-goodness actual temperate rainforest. They get like a billion inches a year. I don't know what the figure is.
anyone who lives in the northeast of the U.S. knows all about lake effect snow.
Northeast knows
all about lake effect snow. And I was actually going to mention something very similar to what you just brought up, which is back in college, I took a course on earth sciences. And one of the ones they did was climatology. And there's these little charts you can fill out to show like the direction of air currents. And when it hits a landmass of certain types, it creates certain effects. And I don't know if most people really want to get that accurate, but if you do, that kind of information is out there. And there is a rhyme to it. I mean, deserts don't appear for no reason.
See, it all depends on how much your players want. If your players don't mind a desert appearing, just kind of, a desert's on this coastline. It doesn't make any sense. Physically, but
nobody cares.
If they don't care, it's fine. When I'm doodling up worlds, I have enough of a general knowledge about, you know, rain showers and life that I just can't let that happen. I'm like, oh, mountains here, and here, then that means this side's not getting much rain, so that ruins this world. Crumple it up and throw it away.
Start anew. D&D world.
You're too hard on yourself, Luke.
Way back in first edition AD&D. When dinosaurs rule the earth.
I wish you people could see him now, because it's even better with the visual.
I'm going to take a screen capture here at some point. Keep going.
Oh, great. I won't pick my nose or anything, man. Or ruin the camera.
I will.
Yay, Photoshop.
No, my very first AD&D map was I went into the back, and there's a little random terrain generator where you start off with hex number 1 and you roll a d20 or a d6 or whatever it was, and it would tell
what the
next one was going to be, and I filled out an entire sheet of hex paper with this until I had my D&D world, and I had like swamps in the middle of deserts and kinds of stuff. And eventually, once I learned a little bit more, I'd just think, okay, why do I have this swamp here? It's a magical swamp because there's something evil.
The old classical.
The sad part is I've seen that many times.
It's magical.
The focus of the whole campaign was trying to stop the spread of this swamp. So yeah, it worked in my favor eventually.
One would think that they'd let that happen so the desert would heal itself.
Dude, it was an evil swamp.
It was an evil swamp. They had to get rid of the heart of evil thing. Well,
that's where you get your black mana from, right?
Yeah. But the most difficult thing I ever did like that was for the campaign that I'm running right now, which is called Savage Earth, and it's not to be confused with Savage Worlds. Totally different.
I'm not.
You should have seen Luke's face.
I predate them by 2 years. Anyway,
you had Savage, and he was so excited, and then you said Earth. And
I was hanging. We were like Edge, and I'm like, oh. Oh, is he going to say worlds? Is he going to say worlds? Oh, he did.
Well, what made this difficult was it was a post-apocalypse fantasy. It's kind of a Thundar the Barbarian type thing. So
I've read your site. I enjoy it.
Oh, thank you. Well, what I wanted to do was I wanted to have a familiar world, you know, our Earth, but I didn't want the players to be overburdened with real historical knowledge. So they say, well, I know if we go up this river, we're going to find the ruins of New Orleans or whatever. Or down this river, I suppose.
I was just saying, how's that?
Well, the new Madrid fault goes off.
That's true.
So anyway, what I did was I tilted the whole planet 90 degrees, and this was the cataclysm that changed everything. And so I now have the North Pole and the South Pole are both equatorial now, and I transcribed the whole planet onto its side so that I could figure out what the new climate zones were. And I had to figure, okay, now this part is temperate. I have, you know, now this is a warm equatorial mass of air, you know. So the campaign takes place on the coast of Hudson Bay, which is now on the equator, and it's a jungle. And I took a lot of liberties, you know, because Canada can never be a jungle. It's, you know, a great big, you know, sheet of granite or something. But I had to come up with, you know, I had to come up with in-game, you know, logic about why that is, you know.
They spilled all their Labatt.
The Hudson Hawks poop fertilize the entire continent.
Oh, no, I've got all kinds of in-game rationalization that makes it, you know, work.
There's an evil swamp.
That kind of rationalization, the ones that, you know, it's just for yourself because the players never see it and never care. It's just for the GM.
You never know. You're going to get that one player who's going to say, yeah, I'm looking at your map.
You're going to get that guy that shows up and writes for 5 pages about the Kessel Run.
You know, I once a year, I get an email out of the blue about somebody asking just the most meticulous, detailed question of, I can't even answer this question. You know, they're saying, yeah, I notice on this page where you've got this particular power. Now, how would you go about building something like, I don't know. I just you're reading this?
Consult the errata. Love Keith.
Somebody who says, I've been reading your campaign. You have? I just put that on the internet. I didn't know anybody was going to read it.
All right, so let's move from the overland map to map category 2, which is the city map. And here I find I have very similar traps to the overland map. That'll either, number one, draw from a real city, which quickly intimidates me because real cities are very, very detailed places. Mm-hmm. Secondly,
not St. Louis.
I will draw them way too generally, like Luke was talking about. I think this was pre-recording about drawing a little pie slice, and that's the merchant district.
Yep, that's the merchant district. Right next to it is the red light district.
Or third, trying to get entirely too detailed with a fictional place and overwhelming myself. Keith, how do I go about making a good city map for a vibrant, interesting city that has the details my players are going to want without getting bogged down in all these problems that I run myself into?
Okay. Fair enough. First of all, Luke has got a good starting point there, which is you need to divide your city up into functional areas. You know, any large city is going to have different areas that have different character to them. I've heard some of you guys talking about St. Louis and the, you know, the different areas where you would or would not want to travel to.
Just most of St. Louis City.
Yeah. Save from the city, you're
especially
fine.
Where I live.
It's true.
There's things like, you know, the merchant district. Well, that's a little broad. You might want to have, like, you know, a rich area of town where
the broads are in the red light district.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you don't want to have something like the Thieves Quarter. Well, you know, who's going to let something like the Thieves Quarter, you know, live in their city?
90% of fantasy and vision towns.
I'm just going to call it that. You know, the Chamber of Commerce. No, you can't call it the wealth redistribution area. Yeah.
Hey, I think the IRS has a complex somewhere.
But no, I'd start off with giving different areas of the city different character. But before we even get into that, I mean, that's how to, like, divide up the city. You need to decide why there's a city there. Or, you know, either base that on your geography or go backwards and say, I need a city that's like this and build the geography around it to support that. Is it a city because it's on a major trade route? Or is it a city because it's the only, you know, green area surrounded by desert, you know, like, you know, ancient Egypt or something?
Is the city built on rock and roll? These are all things I consider when placing my cities in Civ, too. That's a good point.
That's a good rule to follow.
How many shields and food units are around its tiles?
Are you talking about that newfangled video game stuff? I only know StarCraft. It's the only one I've ever bought.
Oh, StarCraft is way post-Civ.
You know, I like what you're saying, though, about cities in terms of taking them back to their purpose and their history. I mean, like Albuquerque started as a health resort of sorts.
Dan fact.
St. Louis... St. Louis was started because of its location along the Mississippi River. The reason that Chicago became the bigger city in St. Louis is because St. Louis didn't complete a rail bridge fast enough.
Did you know Alton was bigger than St. Louis for a long, long period of time until St. Louis took off?
But the point being that you're absolutely right that every city exists for some kind of historic reason. So I think that's a great place to start when designing something.
Cities in the ancient world, before you had things, you know, the Industrial Revolution, you had other ways of moving resources. Cities were built near water because people have to have, you know, water to survive. But B, it is a natural road. Anybody who's gone, like, backpacking and has left the trail and tried to go over honest to goodness wilderness or through a forest that doesn't have trails.
It sucks.
Oh, God. I live in the middle of a little section of forest. And if I walk out my backyard, there's a creek back there that is probably, 100, 120, 150 feet away. it takes me almost 15 to 20 minutes to get there. I've done it once, and I won't do it again. I mean, there's no trail, so you have to go through bracken and detritus that is almost hip deep in some places. It's like wading in a river because you can't see where you're putting your foot. You have to have a stick to test it. So, you know, you're not going to want to build a city where, you know, people can't get out of the city or into the city or get goods into and out of the city, because cities can't live on the stuff they produce within the walls or within the bounds of it. You need resources from outside. So you're going to want your city near water. Another reason that people congregate in cities, and this I got from a seminar, a role-playing convention, is that cities exist so that you can diversify labor. If you do not have a city, you can't have, you know, the guy whose specialty is, you know, tooling leather handbags. You're going to have, like, the leather worker who makes handbags and saddles and this, that, and the other thing. But if you have a city, you have the capability of having people who are extremely specialized. That is one of the entire purposes of having a city. It makes you wealthy because you can produce extremely directed resources. I mean, you know, if you want to buy, you know, I want to buy a saddle, but I want to buy a really good saddle, you're going to go to the city. So cities exist so that you can diversify resources, and they exist because you have the ability to support those people. And in the ancient world, that means some way of getting goods into and out of the city. You need to bring things in, and you need to have some place to export the things you make. So that's something you need to consider when you're deciding where to place your city and how your city is laid out. You don't want, my city's on a mesa. It's at the top of a mesa. It's a major trade city. Well, how do people get in and out?
It's a Masada?
Down that mesa, you know. Well, there's a
Void
ramp.
Of gods.
Well, who built the ramp? Void. Why did you build a ramp to the top of a mesa? The gods told us to.
Well, now, how would you apply this, though, to a science fiction game where technology suddenly makes a lot of these things irrelevant? I mean, you could have a trade city at the top of a mesa because everyone has flying
Keith,
cars.
You can charge Dan for a consultation fee for his own campaign roles anytime.
that gets back to what we were saying, in that I was talking about pre-industrial revolution cities. Post-industrial revolution cities, although you still want to be near water for those particular reasons, you can support a city because you have railways and roads and motorized traffic. In a science fiction campaign, yeah, you can still have, like, you know, the city on the mesa and things like that, but is everybody and every business and every resource in your city going to be dependent on those little sky cars or whatever it is that gets things in and out, you know, spaceships coming down?
Fill trains.
Yeah, exactly, fill trains, you know. You've got
fill trains.
Yeah.
Well, I think even beyond that, surely they put the city there for a reason. I mean, even in a sci-fi setting, you inhabit a new planet, you just don't plunk down cities willy-nilly.
Well, there has to be a big, long strip of neon lights for you to go decking in, or whatever the hell you do in these cities. I don't know, I just play Star Wars.
You know, why are people on the planet? Are they there so they can farm? Well, you're going to want to be in good farmland. Are they there so they can mine well? They're going to need to be near the source of, you know, ore, or whatever it is you're mining.
What if they're there so they can be killed for experience points?
Well, that goes without saying.
And, you know, it all depends on how you design things. You want to play the Star Wars rule where every planet is an environment? Like, desert world.
Yeah. There is value.
Jungle world.
There is value. Yeah. It might not be the most realistic thing, but if you say, you know, we're going to Hoth.
It's easy.
Well, everybody knows, you know, get your parka, you know.
It works. Again, move at the speed of plot. Your ship moves at the speed of plot. That's not a bad way to run a sci-fi campaign.
I think if I was running a hard science fiction campaign, I wouldn't do it. If I was running space opera like, you know, Star Wars, yeah, I definitely. I mean, that's great. Anything you can do to give a place character that is memorable, that's gold. That's gold. If you want to have, you know, people travel to a city, remembers, oh, this is the city with the dancing girls, or, you know, just something, something that city is known for. Anytime you can have somebody just recognize something in your campaign where you don't have to have, well, you know, that's on page 73 of the guidebook. You know, that's gold. That's what you want.
The recurring thing I'm hearing here that I think is good advice for me personally is starting with the map is a bad place to start. That starting rather with the history, the feel, the culture, the economy, the purpose, that's a much better place to start before the map. Whereas I personally have this really bad habit of I sit down and try to start drawing up the map.
It's because I like to draw.
And then try to make sense out of the map as opposed to
They can work synergistically. I mean, you don't want to completely develop the map before you develop the background, and you don't want to completely develop the background before you develop the map. I mean, if if you're really serious about developing something that makes sense and is workable and usable, yeah, you want to go back and forth a lot and say, okay, well, I had an idea about putting this city here, but if I want to have a war between these two cities, I'm going to have to flatten those mountains so they can get to each other or something, or put a pass through them or something.
Let's go down now to the third and final category of map that you threw out there, the battle map.
The battle map.
The individual building or locale where an encounter could occur, and we'll use encounter in the original sense that an encounter could be a parlay or a melee, so you may or may not be whipping out the figs, but some kind
let's
of...
Let's be honest, it's always a melee.
It
fills around.
No, it could be arranged.
Let's think about the chicken massacre.
But point B, we're talking about a dungeon or a tavern or the corridors of a spaceship or whatever. So what is your advice for building one of those?
Well, there's two main approaches, and they all depend on one factor. Are people going to fight there?
That's true.
Let's just assume yes.
If people are not going to fight there, then yeah, you can have a realistic, my hallways are like 4 feet wide because that's about a hallway width. Maybe it's a big house, so they're 5 feet wide. Or, you can have things, okay, well, this is a small bedroom. It's going to have enough room for, a small bed and maybe a little chair or a little table nearby and small window. But if people are going to fight in there, I don't make them realistically. Going with whatever the scale is, whether you use hexes or squares or whatever, I'll change the scale for inside. If your game calls for, let's say, 2 meters a hex, well, that's going to be great for, fighting in a forest or, in an arena or something like that. But if you're going to be fighting in a tavern brawl, you want, a meter per hex or 2 feet per hex or something, so that you have some tactical ability to move around to make the interior area more interesting. And, whatever your game calls for, range modifiers or whatever, just scale that to whatever, number of hexes you're using or the number of squares you're using.
I did always find it strange in D&D when there's like 6 feet between bar stools, just because that's
exactly. what the
squares allow for. Yeah, exactly.
Yep. That'd be the primary difference in the approach. Beyond that, I would say if you're going to do something you're going to print out and use, as opposed to, just draw it on a piece of scratch paper or, on a battle map or just drawing something on the spot. If you're going to be preparing something beforehand, which is what I assume you're talking about, then think ahead of time, not necessarily about, how realistic is this? It's like, well, we're going to have a light switch by the door and code calls for an electrical outlet every 12 feet or 6 feet on an exterior wall. No, believe it or not, I've had people ask me for that. I want a plumbing diagram. What? Are you guys going to turn into water and fight in the pipe? No, just in case we need it.
Bubble bobble.
Dungeons and Dragons is not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
Think about your interior space in terms of what the players are going to need and use. Let's go with a tavern. Okay, you're going to want to have all the basic tavern tropes. You're going to want to have tables and either chairs or benches that they can turn over. You're going to want to have a bar, regardless of whether or not, this town is really big enough to support that. Exactly. Well, there's a bar, because bars are fun. Bars are cool. Bars are where you can go to find the bartender. You don't have to.
Or the quest.
Or the quest, yeah.
The bartender sometimes gives the quest.
You get the quest.
Only when he has the exclamation point.
There's got to be a shadowy corner.
Yes, and an Aragorn derivative.
Yes, thank
there.
You for giving us Aragorn, Tolkien. He gives us every quest.
He's the Green Dragon Inn, and it's 1,000 faces.
In our games, we have a code word, the MCF. If you see an MCF, that's a mysterious cloaked figure. And that could be the guy in the corner smoking the pipe who gives you the quest, or it can be the guy who shows up mysteriously and shoots an arrow into the bad guy who was about to kill you. Or the guy,
the GM still wants to run his campaign.
Or the guy who staggers to the end, clutching a map and dies at your feet,
You four look like
we
adventurers.
We call that the players are too dumb to figure it out, so here's a map.
It's dangerous to go. So
take this.
You want to have things in there that the player characters are going to recognize and be able to use. You're going to want to, if you're going to use this as a battle map, you want to think about the whole interior space tactically so that it is interesting, so that it's fun to use. If you're designing an inn, don't just have that narrow stairwell that goes to an upper floor that has doors going off of it. That stairwell goes to a balcony that overlooks the area, so that your swashbuckling guy could leap off the balcony and grab onto the chandelier and, swing off this, and just something they can use tactically. This is a great place where I can fire my arrows from, you know, inside and in. But just think about your interior space in terms. If it's gonna be a battle map, if you're gonna have a battle on there, think about making it as interesting as possible with as many opportunities for using the environment as possible. Because otherwise, you might as well just be describing it and doing it in your head, which is it's a fun way to do things. Sometimes it gives you a lot more freedom as a DM or a GM to say, oh, didn't I mention that there was a 12th level ranger sitting over there? Whereas if it's a battle mat, you didn't have a miniature there before. I guess I can't. There's a 12th level ranger there.
He was a 12th level ranger. He's like DC 18 to spot. You all suck.
Like a barmaid. It's a disguise. It's a dual class barmaid ranger.
Keith, you and I need to discuss one other thing before, because are we almost out of time, Dan? What are we looking
at? Yeah, we're kind of running up against time.
Okay, let me bring up one thing. We've talked a lot about philosophy. We've not talked about technique. As an amateur mapper with no sense of artistic ability, I have used every free and pay-for program imaginable to try to make maps as beautiful as I want. I've used Campaign Cartographer, Fractal Terrains, Auto Realm, you name it, I have used it, and always to my disappointment. Every time I start to learn it and go, ooh, look what I can do, I'm always, bound by the fact that I can't do what I want with the program once I hit the level of skill with it. Once I realize what I can do, I realize that I can't do what I want. So then I go to Photoshop and look at how badly I can make a map.
Man, that was deep.
I agree with them. I've had similar issues. Is there a program or a technique or something that you can recommend for doing this kind of stuff? For someone who's at the lay level, where we're not...
There's the crux, because you're going to like my answer.
If it makes you feel better, I taught myself basic Photoshop, and I did pseudo-okay maps. Not great, but hey, they looked okay compared to the CNC3 stuff I was making.
Well, in this beautiful modern age, well, first of all, I'll get to that point. Let me go work backwards from point two to point one. In these maps, these programs like Campaign Cartographer or Dungeony or other fractal terrain generator, things like that, they're designed to make it as easy as possible or as convenient as possible, might be a better word, to make.
As long as you know AutoCAD.
Exactly. Some of them have a high learning curve, but they're very, very specialized. And because they're very, very specialized, they are not as versatile as they might be. Now, again, with any program, if you learn it well enough, you can make it do all kinds of things. But it is categorically more difficult to repurpose something that is made for another purpose. For instance, if you wanted to make a Dungeony style map, which is kind of a photographic painted style of map, you're not going to want to use Campaign Cartographer. And if you want to do a world map where you can click in successively, more and more detailed, you're not going to want to use Dungeony. So those things are inherently limited in the types of maps they can produce. And by trying to make one do something it's not supposed to do, you'll probably wind up frustrating yourself.
Even using it for what it's intended for, using Campaign Cartographer to make overland maps, as soon as I got good at the program, I realized how limited it was.
Yeah. And that's one reason why I do not use those things. I had a long, long, long experience with things like Photoshop and Illustrator long before I ever got into doing role-playing game work professionally. I've been using Illustrator since Illustrator 88. I can't remember Photoshop from about the same time. But I've been using them for a long time, so I know how to make them do the things I want them to do. It's easy for me simply because I've got the experience for doing it, and that's ultimately what it comes down to. Well, anyway, I was talking about how, you're going to inherently limit yourself using Campaign Cartographer or Dungeon because they're specialized tools. And right. If you use a specialized tool, you're going to miss out on some of the versatility that you might with a tool that's easier to use or harder to use, but has more application.
And it's also going to require a ton of training and learning curve to ever get there.
Exactly so. And I, fortunately, before I ever got into doing maps digitally or maps online, I had already climbed that learning curve for Photoshop and Illustrator. I've taught classes in Photoshop and Illustrator, so I'm at a level where I can pretty much do or create the things that I can visualize in size. But I remember I had two points I was going to make. One was about a campaign cartographer and dungeoning and that style, and the other one was for Photoshop. So maybe I've covered that both. I don't know. Can you edit something out of that?
I love boobs.
The way that I would collapse this into a nutshell then is if you are using something like campaign cartographer, dungeoning, fractal terrains, they're all designed for special purposes. There's a little bit of versatility. I think particularly with campaign cartographer has a lot of like plugins and extensions that you can purchase for it. But ultimately, you will limit what you can do based by the software you use. If you use a higher end level of software such as Photoshop or Illustrator, once you get past the learning curve on that, then there are very few limits to what you can produce. But in order for you to make your own map, either you're going to have to actually invest the time to learn a higher level program, and there are free versions of things like Illustrator or Photoshop. Photoshop,
the GIMP,
and Illustrator, I think, is called Inkscape. But those are both open source alternatives, and they're going to have a higher learning curve. That is true. But eventually, if you're going to try and produce something that you feel matches what you have inside your head, you're going to have to invest the time to train yourself. It's just like, getting advice on, is there any program that would make it easy for me to illustrate my characters? Well, yeah, you could use a very specialized thing like Poser that can, you know, you can pretty much choose a body type and choose some downloadable clothings or whatever, and you can illustrate some things, but you're going to be very limited. If you want a guy with three eyes, well, you're going to have to learn how to, use Poser to make three eyes or whatever. But if you want to learn how to illustrate, you're going to have to take some classes and practice until you get to the level of skill or expertise that can allow you to translate what is in your head to what you can produce on paper or on screen.
So given that someone like me does not have the time or interest to go out and learn Photoshop and Illustrator,
that's why you call Keith Curtis. You have a fat wad of cash in your hand.
You want to know what makes the math good? That KAC in the corner. That's it. At a point, quality. That's kacurtis.com.
But the alternative for someone like it at the laity level like me would be probably just to accept that I'm going to have to use a suite of simpler programs. There is not going to be a one-hit solution, at least not that we're aware of.
If there was an easy pickup silver bullet, we'd have no Keith Curtis.
Right. Unless
that's true. He'd be out of a job.
Unless you're willing to invest the amount of time it takes to train yourself to use tools that are broader in scope and more powerful, then yeah, you'll have to make do with the limitations of programs that are designed for convenience of use. You're not going to get really good publishable quality that has a unique look and feel to it. People will look at it and say, oh, that's a dungeoning map, or oh, that's a campaign cartographer map. And that'll ultimately, I think, detract from your mapping experience. People are going to look at that and they'll see the style before they see the content.
Which is why I make all my maps in PowerPoint.
It pains me.
It's a lot of copying and pasting, but it actually works.
I've gotten camera-ready art from people in PowerPoint. There were air quotes there for people in the home audience. Camera ready art. Yeah, I've got a label. I've got a package design that I want to use, and I've fiddled this together in PowerPoint. Can you just put that on the press?
All right, Keith. Well, I want to thank you for joining in with us because
thank you for inviting.
Yeah, well, and thank you for coming because this is an area that we've had a lot of thoughts about and certainly a lot of hand wringing about.
I am now well informed.
I am better informed to go out and I'm ready to start making maps.
I feel sorry for Keith Curtis because he's not going to get a new episode of Fear the Boot on Wednesday.
Oh,
welcome to the pain, man.
What?
Because you've already heard this one.
Yeah, you've heard this one. Welcome to my world.
No, you've been given the flame.
I'll be listening to this. Susan, listen to this. I've heard it.
Hey, it's me.
I'm brilliant here.
Listen to how eloquent I am when I say this paragraph. This is amazing.
Yeah, all right.
That's kind of what happens when I go home at night.
Same here.
Adam, as your job is to make me sound awesome.
Easily done. But
you need a voice filter on that guy.
All right, as for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you next time. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2007, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.